Having money doesn't mean that they need an asset allocation plan. It means that they can wait until such time as they actually have real conviction, and then they deploy. And when they deploy, it doesn't need to fit some box that a consultant signed up to. It could be pretty flexible. It can have elements of structure that meld across different strategies, or that have downside protection that might look a little bit more like credit. It might have upside participation that might look a little bit more like GP or you know, convertible warrants or something different. Could have both downside and upside participation. It could be longer dated in terms of the access to the business plan. And actually being flexible like that enables family capital to avoid competing with institutional capital when trying to find deals. I'd argue there's also a whole world of folks who has been fed up with some of the, you know, traditional private equity actors and is seeking a different form of capital that's more aligned in partnership and for long term.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Todd Rich, co-founder, partner, and head of real estate at Declaration Partners, a private equity firm, or as Todd describes it, a family investment firm that invests capital on behalf of Anchor LP and Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubenstein, alongside their own family capital and that of other wealthy families. During this episode, Todd and I discuss his entrepreneurial journey, leading him to help launch Declaration Partners, including how he met David Rubenstein, the differences between managing and investing family wealth and institutional capital, and what Todd looks for in an investment partner. Let's get into it. Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For our guests who haven't had the opportunity to meet you or don't know you, can you take a moment and just introduce yourself and your firm, please?
Sure. First, Brandon, I just want to say thanks again for having me. You've had some really wonderful guests. I've been an avid listener of your podcast and really appreciate the opportunity to come here.
Too kind.
So for those who don't know me, Todd Rich, I'm one of the co-founders and the head of real estate for Declaration Partners. We call Declaration Partners a family investment firm. What that means is that we invest, obviously, our own family capital. We invest the capital of our anchor investor, David Rubenstein, who co-founded the Carlyle Group. He's a billionaire philanthropist and just an all-around wonderful, wonderful guy. And we have more recently started investing on behalf of other family investors as well. I run the real estate strategy, as I mentioned, where we have historically raised fund capital from family and individual investors to invest into properties together. We separately, as a firm, also do private equity and GP solution strategies.
Awesome. And we're going to come back to talking all about Declaration. But as a listener to the podcast, you'll know I always like to start by learning a little bit more about my guests and understanding kind of where did you come from and how has that informed what you're doing today? So, you know, kind of take us back in time. Did you grow up in a real estate family or a private markets or finance family? Or kind of what, maybe give us a quick overview of how you got into finance and found your way to Declaration.
Sure. No, I just grew up as a kid in New Jersey. You know, so that meant a lot of Bruce Springsteen concerts. Bon Jovi was my first concert. Was a big baseball fan, always, still am. My dad was an accountant. And so sort of like many from our part of the world, right? I was a sort of a Jewish family. Grandfather sort of, you know, came over, first generation immigrant who, you know, had to sweep floors and started his own company in the textile business. My dad was the first to go to college. He started his own company in accounting, and I had a dream of starting my own company, but started first going to, I guess, a more prestigious college and then onto Wall Street. So my first role was, I guess, I studied at Princeton. I studied economics and, believe it or not, Latin American studies. And so I worked on Wall Street doing Latin American private equity. And I ultimately lived in both Argentina and Brazil. When I came back, I realized a couple of things. One, I loved living in Latin America, but it just wasn't where I wanted an investing career. Two, I had a view, really, that financial engineering was the root of Wall Street private equity. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there was a lot of trust placed on the management teams. And I wanted to learn whatever it was that management teams knew how to do. And I thought that real estate was this unique mix of investing and management or operations, right? That we could actually underwrite a building, do all the diligence, the financial engineering as required, But then once we owned a piece of land or a building, we then needed to figure out what to put there. We needed to design it. We needed to build it, to construct it, manage it, lease it, and ultimately figure out how to add value. And I just thought that was really compelling.
When you describe it like that, it sounds very compelling. Just out of curiosity, you know, so growing up in an immigrant family in New Jersey, in addition to being very smart and going to Princeton, you know, how did you end up at Princeton? Was it always in your dreams to go to an Ivy League school, or kind of what brought you to that prestigious organization?
Yeah. So actually, this is something I haven't talked about in a public forum. But yes, my dream was to go to an Ivy League school. My dream was to go to Harvard, but I did not get into Harvard. And I got into Princeton actually off the wait list. I was planning to go to Columbia, wonderful school in New York City, which is where my dad lives. I've always loved New York. But I had a dream of going to a place that was not urban, that was a little bit more of a traditional, what I call college quad experience. And I was dreaming about getting into Princeton once I got in off the wait, or once I was on the wait list. And so I worked that wait list hard. I was sending them letters. I was calling. I was, you know, writing updates. I was basically doing everything one could do to beg, borrow, and, you know, convince my way in. And ultimately, I got lucky.
And once you got into Princeton, did you have your heart set on Latin American studies? I'm just trying to connect a few of these dots here. How'd you end up in Latin American studies?
There's no great answer. I started learning Spanish in sixth grade because that was what they offered at my, you know, public school. And I liked it. And I just continued liking it. And so I felt like there was an opportunity to learn Spanish by living in another country. At the time, I guess I went to college in the 90s, graduated in 2000. In the 90s, Latin America was undergoing an economic renaissance. And in particular, Argentina was really growing. They thought solved hyperinflation through a convertibility plan. That was what they called this plan, where they tied their own, or the Argentine peso, to the US dollar. And they thought they nailed it. And so private equity was starting to grow in Argentina. And I was fascinated by that. And so I ended up studying it. I hooked up with some great professors at Princeton in the economics finance department. Ben Bernanke was actually my third reader of my senior thesis. I mean, I was just very lucky. And I applied to go to Argentina to try and study the booming private equity market. By the time I arrived in Argentina, it was in 2001, early 2001. So, you know, the NASDAQ, you know, sort of had already just corrected, and Argentina was really suffering. On the front page of the newspapers every day, as opposed to, you know, the latest soccer score or whatever one might expect, they actually had in big, bold numbers the credit risk premium. So it would say things like 1,642, and that would be the credit risk premium over the U.S. Treasuries. And for those who don't understand credit risk premiums, when you're at, you know, 1,600 basis points, things aren't going well. And so lo and behold, that was one of the times that Argentina ended up defaulting on their debt. And there was a very difficult government transition. I think they had five national presidents in a 12-day period, which, you know, it's just coming from America, where we realize just how lucky we are to have this sort of stability and rule of law. It was really eye-opening. And I learned a ton. But one of the things I learned was that I would much rather invest in the United States.
And you were there as a Fulbright scholar, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Your taxpayer dollars at work. So thank you for that experience.
Yeah. I hope you had a great time. I went there probably shortly after you. 2004, I spent a few months in South America and was in Argentina. And a lot of the byproduct of what you're describing, the banks were closed, no access to money for the individuals, you know, previously wealthy people on the streets. Very, very challenging times indeed.
Yeah, and it's really been that way for most of the past 20 years. I know there's some hope now, but it has been a very hard period for them.
So you returned from Argentina, and you got into...
I went to Brazil first. I then lived in Rio on the beach. I was in the best shape of my life. I learned Portuguese, but ultimately needed to get a job and came back to the U.S.
So yeah, good decision. By way of Rio, you returned back to the U.S. You need to get a job. Where did you start?
So I, at that point, previous to my Fulbright, because the calendar is a little bit different. It's Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere. So I was able to actually work on Wall Street before at JP Morgan before going down to Argentina. So when I moved back, I had already had a Wall Street private equity experience, which was great. I learned a ton, but I had decided again, I didn't want Latin America, and I didn't want Wall Street. And so I had this naive notion that real estate was a way to do, as I said earlier, both investing and operating. And I was very fortunate to join Tishman Speyer, which is a wonderful owner primarily at the time of office buildings in New York City. And I joined a rotation program. I think they now have a fancy name. I think it's called the Leadership Development Program. But when I was there, it was just the rotation. And true to name, I rotated through several groups, including construction and leasing and property management. At the time, they had a dispositions group. I did portfolio management, investor relations. I did all of the things that one thinks of when it comes to real estate investing and operating. And I had a great experience. I was there for over 12 years and really loved it.
Anything stand out to you as kind of, was there one rotation that really just stood out as you remember thinking, oh, this is what I want to do more of later in my career?
You know, I was actually checking. We used to do there was a very formal process for writing employee reviews or self-evaluations or employee reviews. I was looking at that recently as we started to do our own formal employee review process. And I looked at some of the questions. And one of the things I noticed as I looked through my old files is I answered the last question the same way, I think literally for a decade. And it was, you know, what are your goals and aspirations? And what I always said was that I wanted to be a full real estate professional. And what I meant was I wanted to be involved in the capital raising, in the capital deployment or acquisitions. I wanted to be involved in the asset management. I wanted to be involved in whatever decisions one needed to make at construction or leasing or, you know, property operations, and ultimately in the harvesting. And so what I said is I wanted to do all of it. And I guess, you know, now I'm lucky enough that I get some level of opportunity to do that. But that was my goal from the beginning.
Watch what you wish for. Moral of the story, right? So before we get to you doing all of it, so you left Tishman and you went to JBG Smith. Talk to me a little bit about kind of what was the, you know, what were you hoping to get and why make the transition? And then, you know, let's talk a little bit about kind of what you did at JBG Smith while you were there.
Yeah, sure. So I left Tishman Speyer right as the head of their DC office, and I joined, it wasn't JBG Smith at the time, it was the JBG Companies, which was a predecessor to JBG Smith. It's an important distinction because when I joined, it was a private partnership and I was indeed a partner. I was one of the owners. I was on investment committee and the management committee. And it was a really, really great organization. It's still a great firm. But I was attracted to it because it was a private partnership. Tishman Speyer, a wonderful firm as well, is family owned. I just wasn't related to any of the owners. And so I would never, in fact, be an owner of the company. And as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather started his own firm. My father started his own firm. I wanted to own something. I really believed in and still believe in the romantic power of entrepreneurialism. And I wanted to experience that. And so what attracted me to JBG fundamentally was the ability to be an owner of a highly ethical, highly talented firm that had expertise beyond just what I knew, which was mostly at the time office buildings. But JBG was really an expert in mixed-use development and a lot of residential, a lot of retail, some hotels, some land, some industrial. And for me, it was a great opportunity to expand my own skill set in all those areas while also being an owner of the company. And that was just a wonderful experience with fantastic people.
This notion of ownership is interesting. I was just on a call with an industry consultant, and my understanding is something like 80% of firms in the real estate industry that have issued, you know, shares to employees that are not the co-founder, so outside of just the core ownership. So this is clearly a trend. But as you think back on your experience,
that's a higher percentage than I would have guessed, based on some of the prior generations that we both know.
Yeah, there's some cuts in there and some nuance. But yes, I mean, I think directionally, path of progress is, you know, sharing ownership more going forward than it has been in the past. But I guess for you, you know, you really wanted to be an owner. When you look back on that experience with an ownership interest in the business, and what was most surprising to you about having that responsibility, privilege that you maybe didn't anticipate in the days when you were on the outside saying, I want to be an owner, I want to be an entrepreneur?
Well, I'd say the right way to answer that question is really a declaration. So a declaration, I'm not just an owner, I co-founded the company, right? So sort of started from scratch. Now we're sort of a little bit bigger than we were when we first started, and we've grown nicely. what I didn't realize, and I thought I did, but I didn't realize just how hard it would be, just how much work, how it's a full-time effort. This isn't, there is no such thing as a part-time entrepreneur. You have to put your entire heart and soul and being in it. I've sometimes begun describing the entrepreneurial journey as akin to a sort of a chronic illness. And it's not to say that people cannot thrive with a chronic illness. There are plenty of people who have overcome the challenge that is an illness and have been able to do wonderful things with their life. But you can't shake it. You can't get rid of it. And once you decide that you have that bug, that you've been infected by the virus that is entrepreneurialism, it is with you through and through in everything you do throughout your life. And there are real positive parts of that. It's the most rewarding thing I've ever done besides parenting. But it's also really challenging. It can be difficult on one's family life. It can be difficult to bear the responsibility of caring for a team and ensuring that the business grows enough for the team to find career opportunities. There's a tremendous financial commitment that comes with it. I mean, I've, you know, my entire net worth in this one business. You know, so it's it is all encompassing in a way that I read about and I thought I understood, but clearly the only way to really understand is by doing.
That's a great segue. So Declaration, you helped to co-found 7 years ago, now 2018. Do I have my timeline correct?
Yeah, just about. Wow. We're all getting older.
Time flies when you're having fun. How did this opportunity present itself to you? You were at JGB at the time, and why leave if you had, you know, ownership in the business? Kind of what were you seeking?
Well, so at JBG, we ended up, as you alluded to, we ended up taking our company public. And so we ended up doing a relatively complicated reverse merger with a division of Vornado. It was called Charles E. Smith, which is their Washington, D.C. business. And at JBG, we ended up rolling up, and I was part of this team. I'm not trying to take credit. I mean, there's a whole team effort, and there's a fantastic team that's still there. But we ended up rolling up many of our fund investments, plus the management company, into a new entity that combined with most of the real property and the local management company and some cash from Vornado. It ended up into a new publicly traded entity called JBG Smith, now listed on the New York Stock Exchange. That was a fun day, by the way. And I'm building Amazon's HQ2, the Washington, D.C. or East Coast headquarters. They're actually in National Landing, not Washington, D.C. proper. And it was a great experience to go through that. I recommend taking your company public if you have the opportunity. But I personally did not want to stay at the public company because I thought that it would end up becoming a public REIT. And there's nothing wrong with being a public REIT, but I felt like it was a little less entrepreneurial, a little bit less flexible than a traditional private investment firm, and particularly less flexible than what I thought family investors could do. I also happened to believe that there was perhaps a greater opportunity, at least in the near term, outside of Washington, D.C., and I wanted to be able to grow to other geographies. I was fortunate enough that as a result of the public listing, I had, for the first time really in my life, a couple of shekels in the bank, and I was able to invest my own capital, and I wanted to do something that was maybe naive and maybe not, which is to set up a new form of investing, which is really the same as an old form of investing. In other words, to invest personal or private capital in real estate and think flexibly about how to invest that capital, really with some level of, you know, tax sensitivity and a focus on compounding multiple, really growing profit over time, growing wealth over time. And so that was my vision, my idea. I recognized that while I had some level of wealth after the public listing, my wealth wasn't large enough to acquire the sorts of buildings that I had experience acquiring, managing, many $100 million funds on behalf of Yale and Princeton and all that. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be neat if I could convince some super wealthy, maybe family office, a billionaire perhaps, to back me? And maybe he or she would share this vision, this alignment, and maybe we could grow something together. And so that was my view. And I was very fortunate to be introduced to David Rubenstein at the time. I had known him a little bit, but not for an investment purpose. We sat on a charity board or nonprofit board together. And so I reached out to him with this idea, and I got lucky. David was looking to set up his own family office, and he had a view that family capital can and perhaps should invest differently from large institutional investment managers who are great at what they do. It's just different from family capital. And he wanted to invest his own personal family capital into private companies, into private properties. He's a legendary PE guy. He knew how to invest in private companies, but he was looking for help to invest in private real estate. And so he and I, in short, agreed to do this together. David introduced me to a gentleman who's my partner now, Brian Frank, who co-founded Declaration with me. He runs the private equity side of the business, and so he has much more experience there. He previously worked at MSD, so Michael Dell's family office. So he had a lot more experience in family offices and in private equity than I did. I'm just a real estate guy. But together, it has been, we hope will continue to be, a real fruitful partnership.
So this sounds like a Disney-like Cinderella story. You know, I have an idea, and I just wish I could find a very wealthy billionaire to help me out. So I'm going to dial for dollars and bingo, there's a connection.
The glass slipper fit me, I guess. I got very
unbelievable.
Lucky.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. I mean, tremendous opportunity. Let's talk a little bit about, so first of all.
And a wonderful human being, by the way, just beyond the business opportunity. I go out of my way to stress this. It has been one of the great blessings of my life to be able to learn from and work with David Rubenstein. I feel incredibly, incredibly humbled by the experience and very, very grateful.
Well, I'll give a shameless plug for your podcast, The Declaration, and one of your episodes you had David on, and I really appreciated his way of communicating, and it just felt very authentic, and it seems like that's true to form, and it was a really great episode for anybody looking to learn more about David and his career in philanthropy. I'd recommend it.
Well, thank you for saying that, Brendan. David is the ultimate podcaster. I think he was like the original. He's just a fantastic interviewer. I feel grateful that I've been able to interview him. I'm following in his footsteps and in yours, trying to create a podcast. But I recommend to everyone listening here to listen first to The Distribution and then secondarily to Declarations. You'll learn a lot, hopefully.
So for our listeners who are not watching this but listening, behind you is a copy of the Declaration of Independence. Talk to me about kind of how that fits into the ethos of Declaration and perhaps even factors into the name, I'm guessing, but maybe give us that origin story.
Yeah, so good guess. So David is a committed philanthropist. He's committed to giving away literally 100% of his wealth, over time, ideally during his lifetime, he says. And one of the things that he's done is he's been a pioneer in what he calls, or other people called, patriotic philanthropy, which is really philanthropy rooted in our country and in trying to improve our country, to remember our history, and to make it ultimately a better place. As part of his efforts in patriotic philanthropy, David owns, I believe it's 12 copies of the Declaration of Independence. None of them are sitting in his basement. It's not an original behind me. They are all available for public display at museums and other public institutions, a way really for our citizens and citizens of the world to, in a sense, feel the intrinsic values of the document. So David's family office is named Declaration Capital. That's what he owns. And that's really an homage to his ownership of the Declaration and to his commitment to the ideals that are in it. We named our firm Declaration Partners as a similar homage. Declaration Partners is a registered investment advisor. We advise the capital of Declaration Capital, so of David, as well as other family and individual investors. But you're right. I think the values that are upheld in the Declaration of Independence are really wonderful. And in my view, the Declaration is both a foundational document. It talks about the history and the founding nature of our country, but it's also an aspirational document. It also calls out the better angels and asks us to think about what type of country or citizen we might want to be. And I think that's a really great combination when starting your own firm, right? What are the things that you are rooted in? What are your foundational principles? And what does one aspire to? And so we thought the Declaration was an appropriate name.
So today, give us the lay of the land. What is Declaration Partners, your size, your scale, anything that you're able to kind of publicly disclose about how you invest, where you invest, how much you have to invest, kind of whatever you're willing to share.
Sure. Well, fortunately, it's all public, I guess, these days. We are registered as an investment advisor with the SEC, with regulatory capital, I think that's what they call it, of $2.2 billion or so of AUM. That does change quarter by quarter, you know, for all of those compliance professionals looking for a footbolt. We invest in companies and in properties through, and have done so through, a mix of either single SPVs for individual assets, or more recently in fund format, specifically in the real estate space, we have invested out of fund formats.
And as we think about the business and the split between real estate and other, kind of what's the rough breakdown from a, you know, either an, you know, assets perspective or focus of the platform?
So again, we have three what I'll call core business units. Private equity is the largest of those business units, and likely will be for the foreseeable future. And so there we've done a mix of platform investing, that's, you know, long-term hold, cash flowing enterprises that can be, where the cash flow can either be distributed or reinvested and ultimately compounded for long periods of time. Think family business. So we own an aggregates company, a ports business, a couple of other things like that. Then we own some tactical growth. So that's really at the inflection stage of companies that have figured out their product market fit. They're looking to, you know, grow at an inflection point in their growth, and we hopefully benefit from that. And so we've been fortunate to have some great companies, some great brands that we've invested in. That's run by a totally separate team, so I know less about that. Then real estate, which is our business, we have, again, now some discretionary fund capital. We have invested principally in multifamily apartments, industrial logistics, and some self-storage. We have been pretty flexible in terms of the investment structure. So we've done preferred equity, some GP equity, which I know you on your show, you talk a bunch about GP and platform investing. We've done a bit of that. And then we do, you know, what I call good old-fashioned real estate. We'll buy a building, just like every other group out there. Hopefully we do it well. And then we have the ability, and we think this is important, to hold individual assets a relatively long time. We do it in a manner that is consistent with what our investors want, which is basically to find manners to have long-term tax-deferred compounding. And so we have come up with a structure that we think facilitates that. But again, at investor election.
So when we think back to the stated objective for starting Declaration Partners and helping family capital invest differently from institutional capital, it seems obvious to those of us who are in and around it, but for someone who doesn't really understand, what does that actually mean? What does family capital need that's different and apart from institutional capital?
Yeah, so look, the institutional capital space has innovated a tremendous amount over the past 30 years, but it's grown to a point now where I think many large institutional investors hire large institutional investment managers to meet their needs. And their needs are usually to be some form of fully invested. And they want to diversify. And so therefore, they create relatively strict guidelines, often advised by some of the world's, you know, best investment consultants, so that they have a particular way of thinking about their exposure to core or to core plus or to value add or to opportunistic or to distressed into, you know, certain geographic profiles. Like, I only want to do value add apartments in the Midwest, or I only want industrial development in the Southeast, or some version of that. And by the way, that's true not just in real estate. I think some of those rules extend, you know, to the way they think about credit or the way they think about public equities or hedge funds, absolute return. There are all these different gradations, and it's ended up becoming quite regimented. And as a result, the world's investment managers have largely figured out that the best way to raise institutional capital is to convince the consultants and the ultimate stewards that they have a very, very narrow focus that happens to meet this exact need that the consultant already laid out. And then they'll raise a bunch of capital for it. Then they'll deploy it quickly to raise a bunch more in the same strategy. If they have a good deal, they'll often want to sell it quickly to generate IRR and grow the next fund. And those strategies actually make sense for large institutions. I just think that they don't make as much sense for families or individuals. I view family or individual investing as periodic high conviction investing. Families in general are not trying to meet certain liability management. They don't have to fund an annual budget for their family. I mean, they have expenses. Often the wealthy families have more expenses than, you know, me or you. No, but they don't have liabilities to meet. They don't have a specific timeline to meet. They don't have a need for pension contributions or something. As a result, they can be very, very flexible and they can wait. And having money doesn't mean that they need an asset allocation plan. It means that they can wait until such time as they actually have real conviction and then they deploy. And when they deploy, it doesn't need to fit some box that a consultant signed up to. It could be pretty flexible. It can have elements of structure that meld across different strategies or that have downside protection that might look a little bit more like credit. It might have upside participation that might look a little bit more like GP or you know, convertible warrants or something different. Could have both downside and upside participation. It could be longer dated in terms of the access to the business plan. And actually being flexible like that enables family capital to avoid competing with institutional capital when trying to find deals. I'd argue there's also a whole world of folks who has been fed up with some of the, you know, traditional private equity actors and is seeking a different form of capital that's more aligned in partnership and for long term. Lastly, I'd say that family capital has one negative relative to institutions, which is that families have to pay taxes. And that's not that it's you know, it's un-American to pay taxes. Of course, we should all pay taxes. But to the extent that one can find ways to legally defer those taxes, that's a great way to enhance long-term investment returns and to ultimately grow in wealth. Real estate has some specific advantages there. And so in our view, it's important to create a private pass-through partnership structure that enables our investors to take advantage of that.
Speaking of real estate and some of the advantages, you know, you've listened to the podcast, so you know, we talk a lot about platform investing and other sorts of investing. We also talk a lot about the rise of private wealth and kind of how private wealth is coming into private investments in a way that we haven't seen historically. When you're talking to families, you know, kind of what are you hearing? Kind of what's the word on the street? How are they thinking about their allocation to privates? And how do they think about where real estate fits in relative to kind of the mix of options that might be available to them?
Yeah. David Rubenstein would say that real estate was perhaps the original private investment, right? That was the oldest or original when people bought land or, you know, had their home and they owned it. Obviously, that's, you know, it's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I think that certain families in particular outside of the U.S. still really feel that way. Even in the U.S., I think there are certain families that love their real estate holdings and have held them for many, many, many decades at times. I think there is a difference between family office wealth and sort of the mass affluent wealth that has come through the RIA channels. I think in a lot of ways, they're very aligned, right? They're both people. They have the ability to think long-term. They have, you know, some taxes that they'd like to manage. But there's a difference in asset allocation that historically family offices or you know, particular billion-dollar plus families tend to be allocated 40 to 50% to privates. I think David Rubenstein is probably closer to 100% if I had to guess. But so they really have viewed that private investments can lead to excess return, more similar to the way that university endowments have chosen to invest over the past 20 years. Private wealth managed by the, you know, wealth managers or RIA channels have historically really been more liquid market investors, right? The traditional 60-40 portfolio. But I think what you're alluding to is that there's been a movement towards allocating more towards private investments with the goal of creating diversification benefits, you know, decreasing beta, increasing alpha, and ultimately having better long-term returns. So I think that trend is at its infancy. And I think both family office wealth and RIA or wealth management channels will continue to grow and will potentially grow much, much, much quicker than the world of institutional capital.
But it seems interesting that billion-dollar plus families have historically had a significant allocation to privates, and independently advised wealthy individuals have not. It seems like there's an inconsistency there. I mean, I guess maybe do you agree with that? And if you agree with that, why do you think we've seen this dispersion between historical allocations from billion-dollar plus families relative to their wealthy but not as wealthy peer set?
Well, I think there are two things. First, we should acknowledge that illiquid investments do benefit from size in the sense that, you know, whatever portion of your portfolio is going to be illiquid needs to be a small enough portion relative to your overall portfolio that you just have enough liquid, right? And so the bigger you are, right, you know, the amount one needs to have liquid is sort of, I don't want to say it's finite, but it can be calculated. And as your wealth grows larger and larger, that dollar amount doesn't need to change. And so as you grow wealthier, you should theoretically have the ability to put greater and greater percentages of your wealth into illiquid investments. So I think that's part of what we've seen. But I think the other part is that historically, the wealth management channels just haven't really thought about it. They haven't focused on it. They haven't organized themselves around it. I think that's changing in spades. I mean, and many of your guests have already talked about that. But we're seeing it even with, you know, certain of the high profile mergers that where the RIA community has merged with, you know, different groups, historically some groups that have either run their own consulting businesses and or are advising, you know, sort of family office clients, and they're sort of combining forces. We're even seeing it, I mean, obviously at a very large scale, right? For BlackRock, sort of the king of the ETF industry, to it just in the past year by, you know, GIP, HPS, and Preqin, you know, it's a clear commitment to private markets. I suspect that this is, I don't want to say the beginning of the trend. The trend has begun, but I think it's an accelerating trend.
One of the things that we hear a lot when we're talking to groups that are managing money on behalf of wealthy individuals or families is this idea of kind of families and wealthy individuals like to stick together. They like to do things in clubs or groups. And I know that you're creating, you know, a platform to provide a different way of investing for families, but I'm curious specifically around either the network effect or kind of the community that might be implicit in what you're building. What have you learned about the way that your LPs like to invest and who they like to invest with? Is that important for them?
It's extremely important. I actually think that's the great untapped opportunity, personally. We talked about this. We had an annual investor meeting, you know, for our investors in person in Washington, D.C. Like, unsurprising, given our history, we went to the National Archives and David graciously, you know, took us on a private tour through the National Archives. And we saw the, you know, the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. It was fantastic. But the best part was just seeing all of these family office investors gathered in one place and talking about alignment and about how they can grow. And obviously, you know, we, like any other investment manager, needs to focus first and foremost on delivering excellent returns for our investors. That is our job. That is what we, you know, if we can't do that, we're going to be ultimately out of business. We have to do that. But I think that the real opportunity beyond doing that bare minimum will be to create a network of families who want to help one another. And we've seen it. We've seen it when we have been in diligencing a particular property that was leased to an industry that we didn't know much about, and that we were able to call up our families who maybe owned a company in that industry and try and understand the dynamics, how that company thought about their real estate presence and how they thought about use of distribution space, or, you know, in that case, it was industrial space. We see it when we talk on the private equity side about a company that's looking to do customer calls or to find the CEO or CFO candidate, and they can call up their network and, you know, diligence different people or make introductions. I think it's a really powerful tool. I think whatever group is able to tap into that network best is ultimately really going to succeed. I hope we're one of those groups that's able to do that. But I do think there's a real untapped opportunity to create a network.
Before we move off of declaration and kind of onto the market side of the discussion, I really like something that you've done on your podcast, which is you ask all of your guests to, you know, what is their declaration? And I'm curious, you know, I don't know if that question has been asked back to you, but as you think about this idea of being a steward of family capital, what is your declaration?
I love that. Nobody has thought to ask me back. So thank you, Brandon, for doing that. Mine's quite simple. Do good, do well, have fun. And I think it's self-explanatory, but I'll take it anyway, if you'll permit me. Yeah, do good. I think we're all here for a purpose that's greater than financial gain. And I think we have to try and do good for the world. And with our children, we try and instill a sense of community and philanthropy. I'm glad to say that their schools have a similar philosophy. So that's something that's really important to us. I know it's important to David as well. I think it's important to our whole team. Do well. We won't get the opportunity to do good unless we do well. We have to, you know, we want to succeed financially. We want our investors to succeed financially. And I think there's a sense of pride that comes with that. And so that's an important aspirational goal. but we got to have fun. And that's, I tell my children every morning, rule number one, have fun. We're only on this planet for a brief moment, and we may as well enjoy it. And we're all so fortunate that we actually get the opportunity to enjoy it. So let's not forget that. Let's be grateful. But while being grateful, let's also have fun with life, and let's make it a little light. And so that's it. Do good, do well, have fun.
I love that, especially the have fun part. I think it's not said out loud enough. And it's not, you know, it's hard. The world is a crazy place from time to time, and everybody can get absorbed in their individual and professional lives. But just remembering to have fun is really important. My son had a baseball coach, and after, not a big baseball player, I know you're a baseball fan, but after every practice, the coach said, "Did you have fun? Were you a good teammate? And did you thank your parents?" And I love that because it's just such an interesting framing for like what's really important in life.
I love that. That's great.
So let's talk a little bit about real estate, you know, your passion. You know, I know that you invest a few different ways, but you mentioned three asset classes, multifamily, industrial, and self-storage, that are areas of focus. Now, why those three asset classes? Let's maybe just start there.
Sure. Well, they all have a couple of things in common. One is that in general, the supply-demand fundamentals are pretty strong. And I know there are obviously dynamics that are slightly nuanced in each individual submarket or each property, you know, sort of a class. But fundamentally, there's a housing shortage. Fundamentally, small bay industrial in particular is, I think it's like 2% vacant nationwide. You know, self-storage, if you look at the Publix, you know, they're all like above 95% leased, other than those few properties in lease up. There's good fundamentals. They're also multi-tenanted in general, at least the way we do it, which means that you don't really have a ton of binary risk. If one particular tenant goes bust, you know, or just moves out, you know, you can refill it. And importantly, in each of those three asset classes, you can refill the properties without an inordinate amount of capital expenditure. I'll do a plug. I mean, Green Street does great research and has for over a decade about, you know, different asset classes in real estate. And those three sectors have something in common, you know, sort of according to the Green Street reports, which is that they have, in general, a favorable ratio of CapEx to NOI growth. In other words, not a ton of CapEx for NOI growth. And that makes for really capital efficient long-term, you know, growth and compounding. And so that's why we focus on them.
And is your focus nationwide? Are there specific markets, depending on the asset class, where you're more inclined to invest or more focused on because of the fundamentals?
Yeah, it is. We live in a big country, so it's hard to say we'll do everything nationwide. We're really in a partner-led model. And so while we obviously all have individual experiences, and most of our team is in Washington, D.C., we have some people in New York City, that gives us some level of geographic base here on the East Coast. We will follow our partners elsewhere. Historically, we have invested in what we sometimes call the backwards J. And so what that really means, it's Boston, New York, DC, and then around the Sun Belt, the bottom.
You mentioned partner-led model, and you know earlier you had mentioned you're the kind of GP equity and stakes, and you know all the stuff we've talked about around enterprise value. Maybe for Declaration Partners, what is the partner-led model?
So it's a great question, and we can be flexible. One of our hallmarks, we think, is our ability to be flexible and to try and come up with mutual agreement that works for all sides. But we really like to find talented, high integrity, trustworthy partners that have a geographic and or property type expertise. They frequently have an in-house, you know, sort of ownership management model. That's not a necessity. We've done third party as well, but they frequently do. And we like to forge long-term partnerships in programmatic form, often where we're on the GP, where we split GP economics to go and attack them. I would say I think we have 11 or 12 programmatic partners of this sort, where we, you know, we will find some group who has an expertise. Let's just say it's a mid-Atlantic multifamily, just as an example. And they will have an obligation to show us all their deals. We'll have had a, you know, pre-agreed framework. If they show us a property that they want to acquire, we have a couple of choices. We could say no if we don't like it. And, you know, we have said no to everybody. And that can be a little uncomfortable, but as fiduciaries, that's our responsibility. But we could say yes too. And when we say yes, we have the ability to either be small or large. And what I mean by that is if we're small, we're just a GP investor. And so GP investing by its nature is a smaller percentage of the property, of the equity in the deal. Because one of the ways to make profit as a GP investor is to not just get the base property level profit, but to also share in carried interest or promote from the third party LP. In order for that math to work, the third party LP needs to be larger. And so that's GP investing. Sometimes you have the ability to share fees and all that as well. But we also at times have the ability to be the GP and the LP investor. And so for those few properties where we have particularly high conviction, instead of bringing in an institutional partner to promote off of, we'll just do both the GP and the LP position. In effect, that means we are paying ourselves promote or subsidizing the promote. And so we just get a good deal, like a discount in effect, but it allows us to lean into those few properties where we have particularly high conviction. And in the meantime, we have a series of uncrossed investments in a variety of different places that give us long-term optionality, you know, ROFOs, ability to, you know, purchase if someone else wants to sell. It gives us certain control rights, it gives us favorable economics, and it gives us real market intel and information, and importantly, builds trusted long-term relationships, loyal relationships with the partners. And so that's been a real hallmark of how we've been investing.
And just so our audience understands the distinction, when you're talking about investing in the GP, you're talking in the GP of the asset versus in the operating business of the investment manager, correct?
Sorry, great question. That is what I meant when I was saying that. But we, to be clear, we do have the ability and have at times invested in the operating company as well. It has always been led by a real estate investment. We want the real estate fundamentally, but to the extent that we think there's an attractive opportunity to also acquire an ownership in the operating company, or if it's not acquiring an ownership interest, it is maybe creating a revenue share or a fee share or a net profits interest. There are a variety of different ways that one can create alignment across that growth, across enterprise value. And so we have employed multiple different techniques in doing that, but it is always rooted in first trying to find great people and second trying to find great properties.
So I'm going to help you in your future inbox when this gets dropped. Maybe talk to us about what a great partner looks like, because I think in your model, you need to do due diligence, not just on the asset, but also on your partner who's you know, owning the asset with you. So talk to us a little bit about what that looks like.
You know, I sometimes joke that it's sort of like the Goldilocks story. You know, I think a partner that's, you know, really, really large and has control over their own direct capital doesn't really want us in the GP and candidly probably finds their own direct investor relationships. A partner that's really, really, you know, new and small, I sort of jokingly call them two guys in a truck. They might give us whatever GP economics we might want, but like, do we really want them? You know, I think we'd have to, you know, we want to stretch a little higher on the quality spectrum. And so what does that mean? It means we need the groups in the middle, right? The Goldilocks groups that have high integrity, high talent, high capability at finding properties that are worth investing in and evaluating them and identifying the risks and then executing in a manner that they can sort of, you know, deal with the risks and ultimately turn into a profitable investment, have the ability to attract institutional style capital, whether it's a private equity firm, sovereign wealth company, sovereign wealth fund, a insurance company, but not so much capability that they can do it all on their own. They need something. They need a little bit of extra capital from us, maybe a little bit of credibility. Perhaps they think someone on our team is smart enough to help them navigate a particular challenge. And it's really those areas where that group needs something and we can provide whatever it is that they need. That's what forges ultimately a sustainable partnership. It becomes mutually beneficial.
We don't need to go into the weeds of the nuances of structuring these deals, but oftentimes when we're talking about this type of partnership in the GP, alignment is really important, and control and governance and all of these terms come up repeatedly. How do you think about, like, what are the core values? Like, what's really important to you? You mentioned some of the characteristics that you look for in a partner, but you know, when it actually comes to the way these contracts are governed, because at the end of the day, it's both a partnership and a legal agreement. It's a contract. So how do you think about kind of creating the right set of outcomes based on the contractual side of the obligation?
You know, it's funny because I hear other people in the industry, and even your question sort of implies that there's a lot of tension around this question. We candidly haven't found that. And maybe it's just, this goes to your first point about picking the right partners where there's a real sense of alignment. You know, David Swensen passed away, but legendary leader of the Yale Investment Office and one of our former investors at JBG had this great comment that he would always say. And it was, I guess it was in his book too, but it was always more powerful when he said it in person. He said, the best legal agreements cannot protect you from a bad partner, but the best partners can protect you from a bad legal agreement. And I think what he was really getting at is it's the people that matter as opposed to the specifics of a particular document. And we all have very talented attorneys and we all work hard to get a great document, but fundamentally it's a people business. And how that translates into the document, in my view, is that you have a couple of parameters that are really important. It's a list of major decisions. I'll acknowledge that list can grow to like 50 in a development deal, but you have those major decisions. And then it's important to have an off-ramp, right? You need some level of a dispute mechanism, a resolution mechanism. In my view, the most logical dispute resolution mechanism is some version of a breakup. It's a divorce. It's an exit. It's the ability to sell your position, to sell the property. Now you want to do it in a way that's fair. So maybe you allow the other party, a right to buy the property or buy your position out. And maybe that's mutual. But fundamentally, you need to just find a way to allow for liquidity such that if there's a fundamental disagreement, you can go your separate ways.
So we talked a little bit about the kind of ways you like to invest with partners. One thing we didn't talk about is when you invest on your own, in the direct model, is that a long-term buy and hold given, how are you holding these assets and kind of how do you think about duration when you're going direct?
So we like to think of duration as an option. And, I have two quotes on my wall that I guess you can't see here. One, Charlie Munger, who says the first rule of compounding is to not interrupt it unnecessarily. It's a great rule that implies very long-term holds. And just below that, I have a quote from Bernard Baruch, who said, nobody ever went broke taking a profit too early. And it's obviously the opposite. But I think they're both really the right bookends. There are times when if we were to hold something directly, I think our bias would be to try and buy a property at a basis and in a market, where we think it is appropriate for long-term compounding, and we set ourselves up to be able to do so. However, there have been times already, and I suspect there will be more in the future, when notwithstanding those plans, it just makes sense to sell. It could be, and these are cases that happen to us. In one case, you end up doing a major asset management program where you maybe buy out the original tenant, replace it with a new tenant, find out that the financing markets have changed, but the sale markets are still very attractive, and so you choose to sell. In other cases, it can be time when you're about to lease it and you find out that someone comes out of the woodwork who says, hey, I'd like to occupy, but instead of that, instead of a lease, can I please buy it from you? At other times, you just find the pricing is just like gone crazy. I mean, I'm not sure, like if we ever see four caps again, like we might all want to sell, like just remember that, so I think it's really important that notwithstanding our bias towards long-term ownership and compounding, you got to do the right thing by the asset. You got to do the right thing by your investors. And that may mean an earlier sale.
In addition to multifamily, industrial, storage, are there other asset classes that you're not in today that you anticipate or are interested in exploring getting into going forward?
We've done retail, particularly grocery anchored retail. So we still like that sector. It's been hard to find great value, but we still like that sector. We don't do hotels. It's not something we're cool enough for or smart enough for. I'd rather stay there than own them. Office is the one that everyone talks about in our industry. Many of us grew up originally in the office business. I mean, it was well over 40% of sort of the Odyssey indices. It's less now. I suspect there will be a time again to dabble in office. There may be a generational wealth opportunity, but our own view is that it's still just too early. It's too risky. It's too early. The pricing's still going to fall. There's a lot of difficulty in terms of thinking through financing, overhang, the CapEx needs. So I think we're going to stick to our knitting for now on those, industrial, multifamily, and storage.
So I want to wrap up with a few quick hits, kind of non sequitur, if you will, just things that have been on my mind that I wanted to make sure I ask you. You grew up a baseball fan. You said you're still a baseball fan. I believe David Rubenstein owns the Orioles, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
What's your favorite team?
You know, I grew up a Yankees fan. I went with my dad, I think it was to 12, it may have been 13 opening days in a row. And so I'm still a Yankees fan in my heart. Don't tell David. This is just between us, I think. My wife grew up in the Boston area. She's a Red Sox fan. But as I often say, she has other great qualities. And so nobody's perfect. But that's a lot of AL East between the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Orioles. It creates a lot of fun for the summer months.
And your kids, are they following in your footsteps or are they going in a different direction?
I would say that my kids, we made a deal, my wife and I, that when we had kids, she wanted kids a little earlier than I was ready. I clearly wasn't mature enough at the time, but we made a deal, which proves my maturity, which was that if we have kids now, we agree that they're going to be Yankees fans, right? And so that was the agreement. We then moved to DC. They became Nats fans for a while, but there's no debate now. They have switched to the Orioles.
Love it. Well, for good reason. What was your favorite food? When I think of Argentina and South America, I think of food. So I'm going way back when, but curious, kind of what was your favorite food from your time in South America?
Well, there's only one answer in Argentina, and it's steak. There are no vegetables. It's just beef.
Just steak.
But my favorite was that it was frequently more expensive to buy a bottle of water than to buy a bottle of wine. And so that made a very easy decision. It was always Malbec.
You've spent time with one of the most influential thinkers of our generation, if not all time, in David Rubenstein. And curious, like, what's one thing that you've learned from him that might not be obvious to those of us from the outside looking in?
That's a great question. I think David is a study in continuous self-improvement. He has worked harder than anyone for as long as I've known him, and I suspect for 20 or 30 years before that. And he continues to work very, very hard, but he's always trying to learn. I think one of the reasons that I suspect that he likes to hold interviews, maybe this is true of you as well, is that he just learns so much about the people that he's talking with and from the people that he's talking with. There's a lot of preparation work, particularly if he's interviewing presidents or authors or investment leaders. You really have to understand their businesses, their perspectives, the histories. So you just learn so much. The same is true when you speak with investors. It's great. I've been speaking with family offices a lot lately, and just opening your mind to different perspectives and learning from them. I was in Hong Kong and Singapore last week. I was in Brazil and Panama, 3 weeks before that. I'm just learning these different global perspectives from some of the world's most sophisticated family investors has really opened up my own world. I hope it makes me a better investor over time. I can't prove that yet, but I certainly hope so.
And what's one hope or wish for the next, 12 months?
We have a lot of geopolitical uncertainty, not just in the United States, but around the world. I hope we as a community, as a country, as a world, can all work together for peace and for prosperity. I think the past 70, 80 years have been largely peaceful and largely prosperous with America at the forefront. And I hope we can continue. And I hope the whole world shares in that prosperity. I think there's been an amazing amount of innovation that has come through. And we could harness those powers for good. Boy, what a ride it'll be.
If people want to learn more about you, Declaration, want to talk about being a partner or investing, if they meet the criteria, what's the best way for them to learn more about the organization or get in touch with you or a member of your team?
Well, gosh, the first thing they should do, Brandon, is listen to your podcast. So they should listen to all of them. No, I appreciate it. Look, we have a website, declarationpartners.com. We have a podcast of our own, Brandon, as you mentioned, called Declarations Podcast. It can be found where all of your great podcasts can be found. And then, feel free to reach out to me. My email is trich@declarationpartners.com. So very easy to find.
Todd, really enjoyed the conversation. As always, thanks for joining me today. And I look forward to our next opportunity to speak like this.
This has been fantastic. Thank you, Brandon. And it's no surprise that your podcast is so well rated. I've loved it. And it's also, I just want to put in a final plug. You and your team at Juniper Square have been great partners of ours. And I would be remiss to end this podcast without thanking you and thanking the broader organization for that great work. So thank you again.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.